I'm going to talk about the origins and the spread of what I call predictive expertise, and I will explain at length what I mean with that. I will make it to financial crisis because I think it's the last word on the very last slide, but it's not going to be about the financial crisis as such. So what I want to do first is to talk quite generally about the project that I run in Paris called FuturePol, or FuturePol in French, a political history of the future, knowledge production of future governance in the post-war period. And this project started with two very large questions that I had in my head and that I struggled with for a long time because I sort of didn't know how one could turn such large questions into researchable problems, into things that one could do good social science research from. And that actually was the background to the writing of the ERC, because the ERC project was in many ways my attempt to sort of precise these questions into a research problem, and I'll show you the research problem in a minute. But so those two questions were, how do societies create futures? And why is it that certain future paths emerge as legitimate and others sort of end up in the dustbin of history? And that question sort of implies that I think that there is an active social process of creating futures. In other words, I don't think that futures are the result of a predetermined economic, technological, demographic process, but I think that there is a fundamentally social, political process involved. But I also think that it's very hard to identify where in society this process takes place. So where in society do we decide upon which futures to pursue? We would think that this has to do with representative democracy, right? That we choose futures in elections. And there is an enormous literature about parties telling us that parties don't engage in future visions and things like that anymore. So then where in society does this process happen? And can we identify it? And as you will see in a minute, what we point to in the project is the interplay between forms of knowledge production and expertise and political systems. So we think that that is a key place or site in which this process takes place. The second question was, and this leads me to an historical argument, was can we understand the social and and political process of the opening and closing of certain futures? Because I think that as an historian, one can look at a history of the future, not in the Kosellikian sense. I don't know how many historians are in this room, but we're in Germany, so you must be familiar with Reinhard Kosellik's Vergangene Zukunft argument. So I'll talk more about that in a second. Can we study the way that certain futures at different points in time seem to be plausible and possible, and at other points in time not at all? I mean, I'll just give you an example. In the 70s, there was a very big debate about alternative concepts of development to economic growth, for instance, which was a possible future, right? In the late 60s, in the communist system, there were lots of debates about alternatives to the communist system. So these were open futures at a certain point in time that then somehow disappeared or at least narrowed down. So we can actually write, I think, a history of the way that certain future paths have seen possible, have seen open, but also the way that some of those get closed down. And we can understand that as an historical problem. Okay, so these are very, very large questions, but they led me to an historical argument about the way that futures get forged, and they also led me to think very much about the question of the interplay between knowledge production and various forms of governance, so scientific and political production. And what we do in the project very precisely is actually to look at the question of future expertise or predictive expertise. Can you still hear me on the back? So the project, which is a project of five people, so I'm borrowing today also from my colleagues who are not here, posits actually a specific research problem. It's that we ask, how does the future become an object of governance? So how and through what processes does the future become something that we attempt to steer or influence or even control? And so we look at the interplay between forms of creating what we call, what I call knowability. So the future, I mean, there's this kind of Innes's very banal argument about the future, which is, it's not a material object, right? It doesn't have an existence. It doesn't have a being as such. It's not like a chair. We can't point to it. So in order to create legibility to future occurrences, we have all these forms of knowledge production in the large sense, various forms of forecasting or various forms of social science methods or whatever have you, forms of global modeling, etc., that attempt to create some kind of solidity to this object, and that in that process actually produce the object or produce the category of the future, or as it was called for a big part of the post-war period, the long term. So this question of knowability, through which processes of knowledge production and which forms of knowledge then, and with which claims to scientificity, to accuracy, and in a sense truth, does that production take place? And the second question is about governability and political systems. So how does something like the future also become understood as a political category, as a category of action, as something that one can act on and maybe also should act on? And future expertise, or predictive expertise, in a sense, I think, operates the translation between these two things. Because expertise, I think, is a very specific term. And I think actually expertise has a very specific history, because experts tend to not be about academic knowledge production in the traditional sense. Expertise can be understood, I think. There's a very good book by a guy called Tom Medvitz about think tanks in the US that you may be familiar with, who argues that expertise is an interstitial field. Expertise is something that happens between the marketplace, academia, and politics. So we could argue that experts are people who move between different fields, between think tanks, between various forms of academic positions, other forms of knowledge production, consultancy, etc., in and out of the sphere of political influence. So I think experts have a key role for the translation of these two things, forms of knowledge production pertaining to the future and creating or bearing on forms of political influence. Is that kind of clear? So I want to say a couple of words before I do this. Let me go back to this and just say something about Kosalek, because I wasn't sure about the audience. I wasn't sure about how many historians were in this room. So our history of the future is not the Koselleckian history of the future, because Koselleck's history was, you know, the Begriffsgeschichte, the conceptual history of the future, right? And Koselleck and the people who were working with him, so there's another historian called Lucian Hölscher, argued for, in a sense, a very strong chronological narrative. So there's this idea about crisis, there's this idea about how notions of progress are predominant up until a certain point where they get replaced by ideas of crisis, etc., okay? And that happens in the conceptual sphere. So we come from a different perspective, because the first thing that we argue is that when we look at the post-war period, ideas of progress and ideas of crisis are very difficult to separate from each other. There's a constant interplay between these things, and therefore we try to get away from this chronological historicity, or the idea that there are breaks in this, okay, that there is a break with the optimism of the post-war period and then some sort of risk society thing going on. And we say these are actually totally intertwined processes of thinking about progress and thinking about the risks and the problems of progress. And the second thing is that the Koselleckian future-past argument was conceptual, so in a sense it was detached from any kind of social and material practice, right? And we are very interested in material practice in the sense of the various scientific and political processes, including the creation of certain forms of technologies, including the creation of key instruments and institutions that go on in this field and that produce future. So we're moving towards, I think, something that is quite different from the Koselleckian idea, but we can come back to that. I just want to say that as a point of departure. Okay, so some remarks on what prediction is. So it's quite striking that Jens and I have spoken about this several times, that for a long time there was almost nothing about futures and prediction, and now suddenly there is quite a lot of literature emerging. So that is a problem because it means that one has to catch up all the time. But I think that there is still no real good definition of what futurity is and what prediction is. So I'm just going to suggest to you a couple of reflections. And the first thing is that the way I see it, prediction is about power. It's about power over time. And it's about trying to inscribe certain forms of action in time. Hence, generally at least, I think prediction tends to do this. It may not be a law, but I think it tends to do this, protecting certain forms of order, or at least acting on certain ideas of order. So prediction is a key source of social power. In this talk today, I will emphasize quite a lot a kind of Foucauldian argument about prediction as a technology of control and as a kind of governmental technology, okay? That is not all that happens in this field, because prediction, and this is very clear from the communist system, from the studies that we do of the communist system, prediction is also a key site of protest and dissent. So there is lots of struggle around prediction. There's lots of struggle around various visions of the future and how those visions get inscribed in different political systems. And then that struggle takes place in different boundaries, of course, depending on the level of tolerance or freedom in society. So there's a difference here between liberal and authoritarian systems, but I'll come back to that. And to the question of whether that difference is so important. Prediction is also a claim of influence that is specific, I think, and that is different in many ways from how we tend to think about knowledge production or scientific production, because we tend to think about knowledge as operating with a truth claim, right? We tend to think about knowledge as something that someone says in order to say this is true, this is falsifiable or not. There are some forms of forecasting and so on that claim to be true, that claim to make a true statement about reality. Most predictive claims, I would propose, don't do that. And actually, I don't think that claiming to accurately represent reality is the core claim in predictive activities. Rather, what they say, so the scenario methods of the European Commission, the foresight processes, economic forecasting, and so on, the scenarios in defense and security policy, they basically what they say is, we may be wrong or we may be right, but this gives us a basis for action, okay? So that is more important than being wrong or right. So prediction tends not to be so much about claims to accurate representation of reality, but they are claims to influence reality. They're claims to provide a basis for action. And I think this is extremely important, and this comes very much out of the historical study of the RAND Corporation that I will get to. So then we need to think about what that means. And I'm sure that you are familiar with the word performativity. And I will use it here in a very restrained way, because I am a critic of the idea of performativity. I don't think that technologies have agency of their own. I think they are used and invented and put to use in processes in which actors are fundamental. But prediction is understood by actors to be performative. In other words, it is understood as a particular kind of technology that can have a specific influence on processes that different actors understand as having the power to bear on the future, okay? And so some of the predictive technologies or devices that I will talk about, so for instance, the Delphi tool, were very strategically invented not to accurately foretell futures, but to be able to have an influence on the future, okay? Because there were actors who were afraid, I'll come to this in a minute, they were afraid, in short, of the messy futures of mass democracy, because in a mass democracy, you can have a multitude of different futures. So how do you make sure that you don't get chaos or anarchy? So these were actors who thought, we need to find some kind of mechanism of weighing on this multitude and somehow controlling this multitude so that chaos doesn't erupt, or so that revolution doesn't erupt. And they understood these predictive technologies as a way of weighing on those futures of democratic society. So prediction is performative to a certain extent, and it claims to have an influence on the future. It claims to be able to forge specific futures. And if we accept that statement, then there is a key question of prediction in the hands of whom and used in what ways, and in the way that it may act as a naturalization or as a questioning of social order. So is prediction a tool that is used by specific actors in specific contexts as a way, for instance, of protecting certain projected futures of the financial system? Or is it a tool that allows us to question those particular futures? Is prediction a tool that allows certain security political concerns to rule? Or is prediction a tool that allows other actors in the world, in world order, for instance, to question those patterns of interest? That is what I mean when I say prediction as a naturalization or as a questioning of social order. Okay. I think the historical argument will bring these things out a little clearer. So, historically, it's quite possible to pinpoint what I will call here the emergence of the long term, or the invention of the category of the future in the modern sense. And I'm not going to do a long history here. Obviously, one can talk about the future as Koselleck did, all the way back to the Neuzeit, or you can talk about scientific forms of forecasting back to Comte and probably further back in time. I'm not doing the long history. I want to focus on a shorter history that begins more or less with the end of the Second World War, which is a post-war period in which the Second World War played a key role, because the Second World War mobilized certain forms of science, certain forms of knowledge production, which were understood as central for military strategy, and prediction was one of the forms of knowledge production that came out of that, also known as operations research. But so the post-war period sees the rise of something called the long term as a particular category of action in science and public policy. And I want to think a little bit about why that rise happens at that particular point in time. And this is not the same move that happens a little later, that is in the late 60s, when we get concerns with environmental disaster or with population disaster and so on. Okay, this is something that happens before that, and that I think has a lot to do with ideas of trying to control the development of political systems east and west. So the first thing is that the social sciences move from predictive claims in general, because the social sciences make predictive claims. That's part of what we do, actually. I think that's inherent in the epistemology of the social sciences. But there is a shift in the post-war period when we see the rise of very specific strands of social science research that claim that they can foretell the future. So things like forecasting or even futurology, so the science of the future, future studies, something known in the East Bloc as prognostica, global modeling, etc., things that have a very specific concern with the future, and that posit this object of the future or the long term, so that are specifically concerned with this particular category. This is very related to the trend towards applied research, for instance, in sociology and psychology, to the rise of behavioralism, to economic forecasting, to the rise of cybernetics, to a whole range of larger trends in social science. And the other thing is that the future, so a temporal category which tends to be understood somewhere between 10 to 30 years, that's the category that they operate with, is understood as something that somehow needs intervention. So it's understood as something that one can't leave alone anymore. Something might happen in this time period, in the coming 10 to 30 years, that might shake up society, so it can't be left alone. It somehow has to be managed and rationalized and controlled. So there is a kind of political demand. The other thing that I think is important is that there is the rise of a particular form of expertise that I would call predictive expertise, because there are forecasters and futurists and futurologists, and they have very different political color. They come from very different ideological positions. They come from very different scientific epistemological positions. but they understand themselves as a kind of metta expertise, because they understand themselves as being able to say something about something that no one else can speak about. So they understand themselves as being able to speak of the future as a category that is beyond all other forms of specialization in science, and as something that can be construed with the particular methodologies that they claim that they have, so specific predictive technologies, specific forms of modeling, etc. So there is the constitution of a group of people who call themselves or think of themselves as the future experts, okay, or the futurists. And what is very important in that is that while this happens during that really absolutely acute Cold War period, this is a very transnational group of people. So there's lots of transnational transfer, even at the point in time when there is no political communication between East and West. There's all this scientific transfer between the systems around prediction. Why is that? Because there is a political demand in both West and East, because these forecasters, these futurologists, are understood politically as having some kind of particular expertise or particular competence that can help political regimes gain some idea of control. And this happens both in West and in East. So in the USSR, forecasting focuses on monitoring value change after the STR. So the STR is something called the Scientific Technological Revolution, which is decreed in the USSR, which is the idea that you can put science to use everywhere in society, which will improve, you know, productivity and performance and so on in the Soviet system. But then when this is put to use, and when science starts permeating, which of course it didn't, but nevertheless the idea is that it permeates Soviet society, and then there is the idea that, oops, education and science and technology may have effects in the Soviet system that party leaders did not quite think of, did not quite predict. So for instance, it could be that education leads to forms of creativity in populations that may also lead to forms of dissent and forms of protest. It could be that technology leads to new futures of the communist system. It could be that in the so-called classless society, technology and education will lead to some form of value revolution in which the values of the population will no longer be quite concordant with the values of the Communist Party, right? So there's the idea that technological revolution creates radical value change. And this is not just an Eastern discourse. This is exactly the discourse, I'm sure Ariane has been in touch with this, around post-industrialism in Western society. The idea that post-industrialism in societies governed by education, technology, creativity, you can get value revolution so that the young generation do not any longer adhere to the values of the old society as such. Okay, so this idea of control comes a lot from the observations in the 1950s and 60s of radical educational and technological change, and the fear that this might produce effects that are potentially unforeseeable and therefore requires enormous efforts of foreseeability, including lots of investments in new sciences of foreseeability and new technologies of prediction. Okay, so in both East and West, this really starts, I will insist on this, as a problem of control, as a problem of how to control potentially open-ended futures and somehow order them or rein them in. But what is interesting, of course, and what is somehow both obvious and also extremely complicated is that, of course, the conditions of this control or the preconditions of this control are very different under liberal and authoritarian regimes. So these technologies are put to very different use in the East Bloc as in contrast with the liberal world. So I'll just say something very quickly about Eastern Europe, because it's not my particular field. So this really comes from the two people in the project who are working on various forms of forecasting in the Soviet bloc, and who thankfully are very, very good, because it's extremely complicated. Because the sort of simplistic version is to say that there was just one official future of the communist system. Okay, so in the Soviet Union, there were official forecasts, there were the forecasts that were officially sanctioned by the regime, and then there was all this other kind of unofficial futures producing activity, including forecasts that were not sanctioned by the party, that could somehow be sort of semi-sanctioned by the party, because some of these, sorry, unofficial forecasts turned out paradoxically to be quite useful for the regime. So for instance, we have examples of forecasts in the 1970s that predict the total breakdown of the Soviet economy. And then we thought, okay, these people, go, you know, they will end up in Gulag, or they will be dead for sure. But actually not, because somehow that was useful for the party, which had some sort of need at that point to think about economic policy and so on. So it's very, pardon the pun, unpredictable. It's very complicated, but there is this constant play between official futures and unofficial or unsanctioned futures. official forecasts, this is very important for the Soviet system, are binding on social reality. So forecasting in the liberal world are not binding on social reality, but in the Soviet Union they're binding. So statistics are not representative, statistics are performative, and forecasting is too, with possibly very, very bad effects for the people who sort of don't end up fitting into the future as such. Across the countries under Soviet rule, there's a lot of difference. So in some countries, there are forms of futurology or forms of future studies in the fields of sociology, in the fields of economics, that actually very strategically try to push for the opening up of a set of alternative futures or liberalizing futures in the communist regime. So this is the case in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, for instance, and in Hungary. So it's revisionist Marxists thinking about the possibility of introducing limited forms of market mechanisms into the economy, or it's the Radovan Richta group, for instance, in Prague in 1968, which argues that creativity will change totally, profoundly the futures of the communist system, and planning systems has to take on board this idea of creativity. So these things come to very different fates, okay? So sometimes they're accepted because they end up being somehow purposeful or useful. Sometimes they are very severely persecuted, and sometimes they're pushed into dissidence. So this is interesting, I think, because it says something about the need of the communist regime to control the future, which says something also about the political role of the future as a potential sphere of thinking otherwise, of raising alternative, of challenging notions of control. And it probably says something, I think, about the kind of, on the more theoretical level, about the nature of the difference between the totalitarian and the liberal state. So one of the things that I would really like to do at some point is to look in the present on how regimes such as the Chinese one or the Iranian one or the Moroccan one use futures, because forecasting is a very, very important activity in these countries, because there is also the sort of regime need to sanction certain ideologically correct futures and keep other futures out. But that's very difficult to research, or at least it is for me. Okay, this is a very lopsided picture, I'm sorry. And it's meant to illustrate that also in the liberal system, forms of forecasting and futurology are quintessentially about the idea that order has to be protected, and that there is something going on in post-industrial or mass democratic society that leads to the possibility that futures may be different from the present, and that futures therefore have to be somehow controlled. So this is the so-called impossibility theorem by Kenneth Arrow. Are you familiar with this? So in the 1950s, actually all the way from the end of the Second World War up until the mid-1960s in the US, there is this enormous activity with trying to capture the trends of the values of the population in behavioralism, in applied psychology, in political science. And there is this activity with trying to find out what the actual preferences of the American population is, okay? To map the preferences, and therefore by mapping preferences and understanding values, also be able then, of course, to possibly predict forms of unrest and forms of value change or preferences that may go against the grain of the liberal system. So all this activity peaks around 1965, 1966, with the contestation around the Vietnam War and the riots in the American cities. And that's where predictive technologies become directly integrated into American policy making. But I'll come to that. But so from the end of the Second World War, there's this idea that something may be going on in the values of the population and that this has to be monitored. So this is the impossibility theorem, which, to put it short, says, in a liberal society, you can never translate in an optimal way an individual preference. So you will never get, on the collective level, the perfect mirror of individual preferences. So democracy is always second best. You will never get everyone happy in a democratic system, okay? So in a sense, this is a mirror image of the Soviet system, because it's a way of saying, okay, the Soviets have a planning mechanism, so they don't care if people are happy or not. They will just impose a certain preferential order. But we don't have that. We have to find some other way of ordering preferences. How are we going to do it? This is a key problem in the background of forms of forecasting. The other problem with this is that American futurology is completely permeated with ideas of race, okay? And so this is an illustration from the Moynihan Report. Are you familiar with the Moynihan Report about the future of this is the historical term, the future of the American Negro, which became an infamous report. There was a huge controversy around it and so on. And this is a statistical piece that then led to an enormous production of scenarios, which were quite similar to the scenarios, this is 1960, which were actually quite similar to the scenarios that were produced around the Vietnam War, okay? Only that instead of the Viet Cong, you had the black American man. Because they are very concerned in the 60s that the breakdown of family values, the breakdown of the black family, this is what this shows, right? Non-white families headed by a woman, will produce unrest, that you will get all these young, unemployed black men in the cities that basically you have no idea what they will do. Will they become Muslim? Will they be peaceful Muslims? Or will they be violent Muslims? Okay, point of this is that prediction emerges as a military technology, but its fundamental political use is around this. It's around monitoring the interior of American society, the mass, and it's about the fear that in the mass there may be radical elements that are the equivalent, in a sense, of radical, unforeseeable, unpredictable elements in the outside world order, but inside American society. So, to step back a little bit and give you the pieces of that story, the concept, the long term, comes, or at least in the post-war sense, comes out of some very key activities at the American RAND Corporation. And now I am presuming that you're familiar with RAND, which is the Research and Development Corporation of the U.S. Air Force. So it's an institution that comes out of the Second World War, charged with thinking about the future of warfare. So it's a very futurological institution, because they're there to think about new technologies, new ways of conducting warfare, ways of strategic thinking. But it's also, and it has been frequently referred to in social science as the quintessential think tank, because RAND at a certain point in time leaves the Air Force and it goes into policy, particularly social policy, urban planning, and so on. So it leaves the military field and it goes civilian at a certain point in time. And at that point in time, they take with them some of these key technologies, including forms of prediction. But so the origins of this idea of the long term is a very militaristic context, because it comes from observations of large weapons systems. So it's the idea that you have to predict, in order to protect the survival of the liberal state, in what kind of time range the Soviet Union might be likely to have developed intercontinental nuclear missiles that will be able to annihilate you from a distance. Okay, that's how they start thinking about this, because they start thinking about something that they call the long range, which is about this continental reach of missiles, but then they quite quickly start to translate that into an argument about temporality. So it's about the how much time will it take for these continental missiles to reach us, how much time do we have for evacuation, etc., etc. So that is the origin of the idea of the long term. And so it's a reflection on the military system. It's a reflection, actually, from the beginning, of rather constrained technological systems, what social science today would call systems of innovation, because some of this thinking we still have in contemporary forms of systems analysis. What is important here is that such military reflections are then transposed to observations of a completely different system, but in the same kind of thinking, namely the political system. So from the mid-1960s on, the scientists at RAND start thinking about how the political system will evolve. And if you are able to foresee, using similar methods of gaming and rational choice theory and forecasting, scenarios, the Delphi tool that I will talk about a little bit, in order to foretell a potentially unforeseeable evolution of the political system. So they operate a key translation here from rather specific technological military systems to very large political systems. And then we see this actually in social science, because in the 50s and 60s, American political science doesn't really speak about the state, but it's all about the political system. And it's all based on the idea that certain forms of rational decision-making emanating from something that's called operations research can be used then as a way of rationally ordering values and rationally ordering the preferences of the political sphere, so that the political sphere can be scientifically, rationally managed. And then there are some key moves in this that happens at the RAND Corporation. And this is partly a little technical, but it's really important. And it's that at RAND, they are partly really the crazy scientists that you have seen in a number of films and so on, sitting in the war room and manipulating, you know, a board game where they have the Soviet actor and the American actor, and it ends in a big boom. Because that is really the mindset of the interior of the RAND Corporation. And they are essentially the futurists or the futurologists at RAND. They're mathematicians and logisticians. They're very trained in mathematical, highly positivistic, logical thinking. And so actually, they don't believe in prediction. They very quickly come to the conclusion that you can't predict the future. They start thinking that there are some forms of laws governing the long term, so that the future is somehow a nomological object, that, for instance, that rationality is a social law. And if you can assume rationality, you can foresee the future, right? Because you can presume how all sorts of actors in society will act. But then, from the various experiments that they do with gaming and with rational choice and so on, actually they come to the conclusion that you can't do that. Rationality is not an unlimited assumption, but it's very theoretically flawed. So they do all these empirical experimentation, and they come to the conclusion that prediction is not possible. So then what do? Then they decide that if you cannot predict, you can invent methodologies with which you can bear on decision-making, and with which you can somehow seem to control what they call uncertainty, okay? And that you can formalize these technologies in a sort of quasi-scientific way by ascribing all sorts of formalized rules to how you perform these things, like the Delphi technology that I will speak about in a second. And so it's no longer actually predicting the future that is important, but it's finding these technologies, these devices, that is important. And there are a range then of some key technologies that come out of the RAND Corporation and that then become very important, because they're actually fundamental political technologies of the present. So things like the scenario tool, you know, that the European Commission produces enormous amounts of these things, the forecasting, the foresight, the Delphi tool, and they're all about decision-making under uncertainty. At RAND, they call these things, these technologies, social technology, and they call themselves social engineers. Why? Because they understand these technologies as not just representing probable futures, but as allowing them to act on desirable futures. So they understand them as, in a kind of absurd way, as normative, right? Because they have this capability of forging the social world. But they also say, we're not normative, we're just scientists. We're just giving you the tools with which to rationally evaluate which future is better than another one. Okay, that's the kind of intellectual mindset of these people. But there is a very clear idea that through these technologies you can control, or you can at least increase the controllability of potentially unforeseeable events in outside world order and inside American society. All of these technologies that they label social technology rely on the systematic use of expertise. So I don't want to talk for too long, but I can talk for another couple of minutes. So this is the Delphi tool, which is used today everywhere. For instance, this is why financial crisis comes in, by the ratings agencies, in order to determine the ratings of nations, you know, the likelihood of default and so on. And Delphi is a tool for decision making under uncertainty, because it is a tool for consensus creation among experts. So Delphis are expert panels who are faced with a number of questions pertaining to the future. So in the 1960s, for instance, the likelihood of nuclear war, so the likelihood of a Soviet attack on the US. And it's a reiterated exercise. And in between of each time this question is put, or the relevant question is put to the experts, they are invited to consult each other's responses. So they're invited to contemplate how other people have replied. And then you see what happens, right? So the first time, this is the question of the likelihood of a nuclear attack by the Soviet Union on the US. So the first time, actually, these experts don't agree at all, right? These are very scattered responses. And the sixth time is quite a lot of clustering, translating to the idea that such an attack is actually very probable and will happen rather soon, okay? So Delphi was, and this was not a coincidence, this was not a somehow unlucky effect of this exercise, but it was really very strategically forged so that by making experts confront to each other's opinion, you would get them grouping around something that could then be understood as the most reliable kind of knowledge about the future. Okay. So prediction is domesticated from the late 1960s on as part of a kit of tools called decision tools, so the tools of modern politics. And this is part of a kind of second wave of planning that happens in Western systems, well, actually in Eastern systems of governance too, from the mid-1960s on. So it's part of a kit of tools, amongst which are also PPBS, for instance, program budgeting, cost-benefit analysis, etc., and that is now understood as susceptible to help you monitor social change, oversee values, but also evaluate the efficiency of resources in public administrations. Something happens with the long term at this point, because the concept of the long term is now translated to the idea of a generation. So it's the idea that you need to invest heavily, for instance, in systems of education or in social policy or in fighting poverty, or in pension systems, and then you need to be able to foresee the effects of such investments over the time span of a generation. So it becomes about very much about the evolution of mass democracy, and also about actually controlling the state, controlling growing public administrations, because when public administrations grow, as they do in the 1960s, there is the idea that also that can have unforeseeable effect. You could get some kind of bureaucratic ungovernability problem or some form of administrative chaos from this growth. So such growth has also to be foreseen. Social technology is spread to Europe through distinctly liberal networks. And we're working in the project right now on a collective network analysis of the network of forecasters, because they're quite identifiable. You can really see how they constitute themselves as a group. They go to the same conferences, the same seminars, they end up in the OECD, they end up in the French Planning Commission, they end up in planning networks in Eastern Europe, so they sort of spread. And they're directly, oftentimes very directly connected to the RAND Corporation or to the US administration, and they're equipped with these technologies. I'm going to skip the parenthesis of NEO, and you can ask me about that in the questions, because otherwise I'll take too much time. But these are networks that cross with the networks of neoliberalism as a historical movement. And so from the late 1960s onwards, forms of predictive expertise equipped with these tools, like the Delphi tool, become a central input on governance and as part of a kind of reshaping of governmentalities around the idea of uncertainty. And at that point, if it's not already clear, this is really not about the future at all. It's not about the idea that there can be open-ended horizons of change and so on, but it's really a reflection on how to create fundamental forms of stability. And what is interesting is that the red thread in this, all the way up to actually the foresight processes that the European Commission does today in the backdrop of financial crisis and rising contestation in Europe and so on, the red thread in this is really understanding the values of mass public and also communicating, sort of normatively trying to care, to bear on the way that people understand change, the way that change is communicated and the way that that individuals understand the future. So this really remains the fundamental red thread, I would say, of prediction. This is really the final end. So this picture says, we realized we could make a buck on this, which is an authentic quote from one of my interviews, who is this guy over here, who's now 90. And this is a board game that they developed from the Delphi tool. So they actually developed a board game. It's a board game. This is the big model, and then they produced it in a nice shape like this. Looks like a Trivial Pursuit game. And they did that for a major American corporation called Kaiser Aluminium, which is a steel corporation, and they sent that out to all the clients of that corporation. When he told me about this, I thought this was completely just a gimmick or something like that. And then I realized that Kaiser Aluminium was a major player on the aluminium market in the Cold War era, so they were extremely involved in controlling price movements on the market for natural resources such as aluminium, which is a very geopolitical issue. So this is important. It's not a gimmick. This is a key thing. But why did we realize that we could make a buck on this? Well, because from the mid-1960s on, for various sorts of reasons that I'll now skip, the people at RAND outsource, okay? So they go private, and they realize that they can sell these tools, these technologies, as the tools for decision-making under uncertainty, and that there is a whole range of public and private clients that are potentially very interested in these tools, like Kaiser Aluminium, like various American states, NGOs, institutions of global governance like the UN, and that these tools can be put to use to really any kind of subject, like everything from famine control and fighting epidemics or predicting epidemics, to eventually the detection of financial risk. And this is, I have to leave it here because I'm trying to trace exactly how they sold it and how they worked with these things. But I think that is traceable. I think one can actually study precisely how these tools traveled and therefore also sort of understand something of the geopolitical aspect of prediction. Because this means that these tools become directly implicated in fundamental processes of decision-making from the corporate level to really the very highest level of global governance. What happens with this is that it breeds something that I call the futures market, so an enormous consultancy activity of these future experts, self-appointed, more or less, self-accredited, equipped with these tools, and these experts are everywhere in contemporary forms of governance, on something that really looks like, I would argue, a market. In other words, not only these tools, but also specific visions of the future are actually projected, produced, sold, usually, or at least this would be my hypothesis, not in a kind of neutral or objective way, but with the anticipation of what the client wants. So this is already built into the production, which then feeds back to the first, hold on, to the question of prediction as a kind of naturalization or as serving certain interests of the present, or as a possible questioning of social order. So I'll stop there.